Coming up on Tech News Weekly, Jason Howell and I start out the show by talking to Zach Hall of 9to5 Mac about the COVID-19 exposure notification API. It's a lot of words that basically mean that Apple and Google have teamed up to give people more information about when they are exposed to COVID-19. Then we head to the story of the week, or maybe it's the story of the month. It's all about the gig economy, what companies are succeeding, what companies are not doing so well in this time, before rounding things out with Drew Harwell of the Washington Post, who comes to talk about working from home and some companies that maybe are paying more attention to their employees than others. There is a lot to check out in this episode of Tech News Weekly, so stay tuned. Tech News Weekly is brought to you from Twit's LastPass Studios. You're focused on security, but are your employees? Well, LastPass can ensure that they are by making access and authentication seamless, whether they're working in the office or remote. Visit lastpass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 132, recorded Thursday, May 7th, 2020.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Use IT Pro TV for 100% remote conferencing and training. Go to itpro.tv/twit2 to start setting up your next conference today. Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and a break in the tech news, and sometimes we zoom in dramatically to the camera. I am one of your hosts, Micah Sargent.
And I'm Jason Howell. How you doing, Micah? It looks like we got the same memo for our wall color and the same memo for our shirts. I did not get the memo for the white baseball hat.
Sorry. That's awkward. It will reflect in your performance review. But until then, I suppose we will just have to venture forth. Fourth word and fifth right.
Let's do it.
All right. So yesterday was a day, and on that day, I uploaded my iPhone to the latest version of the iOS beta. Yes, I am a nerd who runs beta software on my device. And one of the things I was surprised to see on my device, tucked away in the privacy settings, was exposure tracking, a feature that Apple and Google have sort of partnered up on to release an API that different app users can take advantage of to essentially track their exposure and others' exposure to COVID-19 or to this novel coronavirus. There's a lot involved in this, and there's sort of a lot to dig into, and so I thought it'd be great to bring on the lead editor over at 9to5 Mac, Zach Hall, who is back with us today. Hello, Zach.
Hey, good morning. It's nice to all be coming in from our homes now. Still evening with you all.
Yes, we all are coming in from our respective locations. Let's kick things off. I think that the best way to kind of break into this, I think that there's been, you know, a lot of information for folks who listen to this show and listen to different Twitch shows or watch Twitch shows, probably know a little bit about this this tracking API. But can we talk a little bit about what is involved? You know, we don't need to go too deep or anything like that, but sort of, is it Bluetooth? Is it Wi-Fi? Is it GPS? What is the API sort of set up to do?
Yeah, sure. So the thing about this is, you know, when I first learned about it, even just reading, you know, kind of glancing at our coverage, you don't really get how privacy focused it is until you dive in. And I think that's been one of the challenges of communicating this from Apple and Google's perspective, is that it's, you know, the original name for it was contact tracing. And that sounds kind of, you know, like it's tracking you. And they changed the name of this to exposure notification, because it's more specifically what the goal is not to know where you've been, but to know if you've been in contact with someone who test positive for COVID-19. And so the way it works is that it uses Bluetooth only and not GPS, not location services. There's no map involved. I think of it as like if you close your eyes and you cover your ears and you have no idea where you are, you just know if you bumped into somebody, for example, then there's a record of that, that yes, we bumped together, we traded tokens. The tokens are stored for 14 days. And then if that other person or you test positive for COVID-19, then they're notified that they've had exposure to COVID-19 in the last 14 days. And they don't know who, they don't know where the person,
I mean, it could be someone like at the grocery store. It could be someone at a park.
It's nothing to do with the person specifically. And that's what makes it sort of less scary. It's also less informed that way, but it's a good balance of trade-offs there.
As this thing has continued to develop and move on, we've seen improvements to the way that Apple and Google even talk about the contact information. So, the 9to5 Mac article links to different information, and one of those is a page with Apple and Google listed, and it's that. Apple very clearly writes privacy preserving contact tracing, and then has information about the Bluetooth spec, the cryptography spec, the framework API, and then of course frequently asked questions. And one of the things that Apple and Google have put forth are sample code guidelines and some concepts. Do we have information on kind of what the guidelines are? Is this something that, you know, Apple and Google are going to keep available to folks after COVID-19 eventually dissipates? Is this something that, you know, is only going to be available for this period of time? And what are some of the framework and structure that Apple and Google have set up to say, here's how it's limited, here's what can and can't be used?
Sure. So it's important to know that this works on Android and iPhone. So that's the whole point, is that it can be anyone with a compatible smartphone. The next thing is that the apps that use this, there will be one app per region, which means like state or country, that can even use this API. And they have to have a special entitlement from Apple or Google to build the app for this. So you can expect like the equivalent of a CDC app per state or per country. And the specific app is not allowed to access the API and location. So they can't use location services or GPS. And the way that the Bluetooth stuff works is that the kind of token I mentioned before is a randomized number, and it changes every 15 minutes. And this is something that's changed throughout the process of communicating this as it's being developed. And then the data can be removed by the user as of the release yesterday. You can go in and manually remove the data if you want to say, I no longer feel comfortable using this. You also have to opt in multiple times. So you've got to opt in to be able to give the app permission to use the API and opt in to give iOS the permission to offer the API. So there's a lot of permission asking and asking again to make sure you really are doing this, you know, because you want to. And everything goes away after 14 days. So it's kind of on a rolling basis. You know, if the interaction with someone at the park was 13 days ago, tomorrow it'll go away. And Apple said that they will close this down, so it won't be a permanent feature in iOS or for Google and Android, but it'll be shut down region by region as necessary. And that's kind of the whole point of this thing, is that it's not meant to replace social distancing or safer at home orders. Instead, it's more along the lines of, you know, access to testing. It requires that, really, or other ways of verifying COVID-19 status. And it's additive for limiting the spread of the virus as more people go back to work and school or just in the public. And it doesn't necessarily remove the risk from social interaction, but instead it kind of removes the mystery of being informed for those who cannot stay home. So it's just one more piece of information to help prevent the virus spread.
So I see a couple of really big challenges with this as we kind of move forward, as these kind of finally materialize and become tools that people can actually use if they choose. One is mistrust. You know, there's a lot of people, there's been a lot of information the last couple of years, especially, and then most recently, you know, around this, a lot of speculation as far as, okay, well, but what's really behind this? What's really happening? And a lot of people who just don't trust, even when they're told that from a company that, you know, hey, there's nothing to worry about, people are still going to, you know, poke holes in it and find reasons why they should worry. Mm-hmm. That's one. Two, I think, is a really big challenge here, which is awareness. If these features are rolled out, maybe people have heard of it, maybe they haven't. Whether they trust or distrust or mistrust the fact that these features even exist, how are they going to be made aware of this explicitly? Like, it's one thing to hear about this or read about this in the news and your phone updates, and you have it in there and you just never think to like pick up your phone and opt in, which is what you need to do in order to participate. And what people need to do in order for this to even be effective is to have a lot mm-hmm. of people using it. Is there going to be any sort of like onboarding, like are you aware of like an update hits these phones and then, you know, Apple is presenting a message to say, hey, by the way, with this update, we've got this new tool that you do need to update or opt into in order to participate. Here's how you do it. That way people are presented with like an action that they can take right then before they forget about it.
That's a great question. And something I'll say on this is that there have been more briefings on this specific subject from Apple and Google together than on any single, you know, news release in the past before. I mean, they've had at least three or four so far, and I imagine we'll see many, many more before this is released and you know, toward the end of the month. And they've not really given a way of how will this be so clear that adoption is just is enough to be effective yet. They've literally said things, you know, kind of behind the scenes of like, we're relying on you to tell the story and to get this information out there. And so, you know, that's one aspect of it. The other thing is that if there were multiple apps per state and region, you know, where it was like you pick between, you know, which one you trust, then even if they all use the same API, then it would be a little bit messy as to which one you choose. And so they're using a single app. I imagine this will be like front page on the App Store and the Google Play Store for a while to promote it. And those, mm-hmm. you know, those various places see high activity in terms of people, you know, active users coming to those places. So that will help. But I'm not sure that we'll see something like, you know, when you see like an emergency alert, for example, that would be kind of useful, like a push notification for everybody. And there's so many steps to making this work. You know, you've got to have the phone, update the phone, download the app, give permission, and then go to a doctor that knows how to participate in this as well. So it's tricky. What would be more effective is if you made this mandatory and just on by default, but then that would open up all kind of issues with privacy and litigation and everything. So we can't do that way. So that's the thing. We'll see. And they've kind of voiced, you know, some of us have asked before directly on these calls. It's like, what kind of participation do you need for this to really be effective? And because it's not been done before, there's not a clear answer, but they're looking at like, you know, in the communities that this is critical, above 50% for this to be useful at all. So it really comes down to spreading the message and communicating why it isn't like GPS tracking and recording where you were when you were there, but it's just that trading a token anonymously situation.
Wow. There's clearly a lot to dig into here. And we do appreciate you taking the time to help kind of explain some of the things. And we'll be keeping an eye on this as well. And I'm sure you will be over at 9to5 Mac. If folks want to follow you online and see all the great work that you're doing, where do they go to do that?
You can check out 9to5 Mac. We got a lot of stories there. And I'm on Twitter at Apollo Zach.
Yep. Awesome. Awesome. Zach Hall, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Zach.
All righty, folks. Up next, the story of the week, or perhaps the month. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by IT Pro TV. We've all been dealing with a lot, and IT Pro TV wants you to know they're here to help both you and your business. Working from home while trying to conduct training and conferences that your business relies on can be challenging. IT Pro TV has solutions not only to make that happen, but they can do it with incredible video, audio, and expert advice. They have the capability to set you up with 100% remote conferencing so you can get training done for your company while maintaining social distance. You need IT Pro TV because they have the tools to make your conferences a success. Don't let working from home stop you from delivering the best content for your workforce. With IT Pro TV, you can create your own training videos and customize training that meets your organization's needs. You can get everything you need to create customized video training with the IT Pro TV Custom Content Program and leverage the power of video learning, along with the convenience of turnkey service. From planning to post-production, you can choose the services you want and execute your video strategy easily. Plus, use IT Pro TV's hosts, your hosts, or both. You can use subject matter experts to add a professional touch to your video content and add your own subject matter experts for a powerful combination of on-camera experience and industry knowledge. Choose the studio you want to use. Pick from several distinct HD studios. Plus, choose the warehouse for an urban feel, the business set for a corporate look, or get techie with the server room. IT Pro TV are the experts in IT training and certification. If you're using this time to learn more about IT and get certified, check out all of their amazing programs for you and your team. And don't forget, they have online IT training too, and it's 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscription. Start planning your business and training conference today with IT Pro TV. Go to itpro.tv/twit. Two, they have the equipment, the studios, and the knowledge to make your next conference a success. That's itpro.tv/twit2. That's the number two, by the way. IT Pro TV, build or expand your IT career and enjoy the journey. Thanks so much to IT Pro TV for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. All righty. What is the story of the era?
Definitely the one of the big stories of the year. And of course, it ties in directly with the biggest story of the year, which we can all probably agree is the coronavirus. But this is very related. The gig economy, you may or may not have noticed, is being turned upside down right now. Some services seemed pretty safe or relatively safe by comparison prior to the pandemic. Now they're fighting to stay afloat. And so I wanted to just take a few minutes to kind of point out what some of the biggest names, like the fluctuations that are happening right now, because it's all happening simultaneously. Uber, to start off with, they just announced to employees that they're reducing staff by 14% worldwide. That comes out to around 3,700 jobs going away. 180 driver service centers are closing. That's 40% of them worldwide. CEO Khosrow Shahi says that more difficult adjustments are going to be made over the next few weeks. So as if that isn't enough, you know, of course, Uber has to do what businesses have to do right now. They have to keep constant eyes on how this is developing. But that signals some other big changes that could happen literally in the next 14 days. So we'll see what happens there. But I mean, 14% of staff reduction on a company like Uber that was sailing prior to all of this is a really big deal. And then you have their direct competitor, Lyft, which also announced last week. So this is a little bit older, but last week, 17% staff reduction, 5% or more being furloughed and salaries being reduced for 3 months. Were you going to say something, Micah?
Oh, no, I was just I was kind of reeling in this 14%, 17%. Yeah, I was just wow. That's I mean that sincerely. You know, this is people's livelihoods. This is, you know, real human beings. When we look at these percentages, I think sometimes whether it be percentages of death, percentages of workflow reduction, all of these terms and adjectives and verbs that get thrown in there and numbers that sort of obscure the fact that at the heart of it, at the root, these are human beings who are all who all have desires and needs and families and friends and things of their own. And unfortunately, and also fortunately, it is a mechanism psychologically for us to protect ourselves by separating the impact of what's happening by sort of distancing. And so what I mean by that is if we actually felt the pain and sadness, if we truly 100% empathized with these folks, we would never get anything done because we'd be constantly depressed. And so it is a mechanism, a protective mechanism, to look at these percentages and only think of them in that way. But in doing so, we can't lose sight of the fact that those are individuals. 17% of staff, that's 17% people, human beings who've lost their jobs. And so it is important, I think, to take a second and just go, you know, wow, that's a lot of people.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I mean, it doesn't stop there. Airbnb announced this week they're cutting its staff by one quarter. So again, you know, to put that into numbers, 1,900 out of 7,500 employees. And as we know, I mean, travel industry is just being wrecked right now. We had the interview a few weeks ago about Airbnb and how that's been affected. They say that they acknowledge they don't know when things are going to return to, quote, normal. Also that travel is going to experience a new normal once things even do reverse ultimately. And I think that's probably the case for all of these services. You know, one big kind of thread through all of this, even before COVID-19 kind of came onto the scene, was the fact that, you know, California in January passed through the new state law, Assembly Bill 5, that was basically the state effort to classify drivers of Uber and Lyft as employees instead of as contractors, basically making it harder for these companies to hire as contractors, because when they have to hire as employees, they have to offer things like benefits and sick time and all this kind of stuff that is obviously very costly to their bottom line. And in the gig economy, they're looking to save as much money as they can through all of this. They're actually fighting this right now. Uber and Lyft are not, you know, following along with this new law. So they have the potential, they're being sued by the state of California right now and have the potential of losing even more if that comes out, you know, in favor of the state of California. And, you know, I'm sure that affects employees at Airbnb as well. However, on the flip side of this, we have companies like Instacart, you know, is the grocery delivery service. I've never actually used Instacart. You get a deliveries through Instacart. Am I correct in that, or is it a different service?
Well, so I think what you used, maybe if you've used the Prime Now delivery service,
okay, all right,
to do Whole Foods deliveries, that is what I have used. However, Instacart is partnered with it's Sam's Club for Northern California.
Costco.
Yeah. So back home, it's Sam's Club is the big one. Costco is not as well known. Anyway, they are partnered. Instacart and Costco are partnered. And so if you buy things from Costco and have them delivered, it's via Instacart. So a lot of grocery delivery services are using Instacart as the sort of go-between. That's one of several, I think, that folks are using. So it's certainly worth talking about there for sure.
Yeah. They've seen their first ever profit in April, $10 million profit. Basically, there's a fantastic article on Bloomberg that you should definitely read. Ellen Hewitt and Lizette Chapman. It's kind of their feature article of the upcoming issue of the Bloomberg magazine. But it does a deep dive on Instacart and just basically says, like, Instacart had planned to be at this point, you know, based on the like immediate success that they're seeing as a result of COVID-19, they had planned to be at this point in a couple of years. And instead they reached it in a month, just because suddenly demand was so high.
Wow.
They're looking to process $35 billion in grocery sales just this year. However, you know, that there is a cost here. Deliveries used to be within an hour. Now it's like within hours, days, weeks. The article actually refers to it as eventually cart, which I thought was kind of funny. Instacart employees expanded from 180,000 up to 500,000 in 8 weeks. So talk about like expansion there. And I mean, they you know, their systems, their approach has had to scale up to meet the overwhelming demand of people who in many cases are just, you know, their medical condition is such that they don't even want to risk going anywhere, getting anywhere near this virus. And so turning to delivery methods like Instacart, They're targeting 750,000 employees by this summer, so increasing another 250,000 over the course of the next couple of months. And, you know, very similar here as well. They're contractors. They're not full-time employees, so the workers are not seeing any workman's comp benefits, no unemployment benefits being accrued. You know, there have been a couple of strikes, one of them in collaboration with Amazon, which was on May 1st, just not too very long ago, to try and kind of bolster up these, you know, the reasoning of moving this staff into employee status instead of contractor status, so that they're protected. Because right now you want to be protected, especially if you don't have those health benefits and you're putting your life on the line going out there, increasing the chance that you're going to pick up this virus. Like, that's a bad, bad scenario on both sides.
Yeah. And see, this is the thing. There's just a balance that we're seeing where some companies seem to have made the right choice in, I mean, and this, of course, it's completely random, it's chaos, but some companies just so happen to have the right businesses that work better in this environment, and some have businesses that do not work better in this environment. And to see how clearly these businesses thrive in this environment while other ones are not thriving, it's, as an outsider looking in, it is something, you know, to watch and to try and understand. Kind of course it makes sense for something like Instacart or similar grocery delivery services to be doing super well. I have not been able to, I haven't tried in a while because I kind of gave up on doing it because every time I was disappointed. But for the longest time, I would try to use the Prime Now delivery service and I could not get a delivery because it was used so much. So that's just been fascinating to see what businesses are thriving in this environment. And I'm sure that, you know, there are going to be some startups that are either pivoting or completely starting anew in this time that are focused on this kind of existence. And that shapes things as well.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. We're going to see some interesting pivots as far as that's concerned. And you know, they're going to have to come up with it soon in some cases. Uber and Lyft, you know, there's not a whole lot of demand for these ride shares right now. How do they pivot? One thing I thought was interesting, and we actually have to get to our next interview, but one thing I thought was interesting is that Uber scaled back on its Uber Eats, which I was thinking, like, wait a minute, this kind of seems like the right moment for Uber Eats, right? Like, people want delivery of food. Like, why would you scale that back? I realize maybe it's not your main moneymaker, but that seems like a way to keep drivers driving and to kind of, from a company standpoint, benefit off of this current scenario of people not wanting to leave their homes or being told they can't leave their homes or shouldn't.
Yeah, so. I agree. It's I found it odd. And DoorDash was there have been a couple times where they were not doing deliveries. They are again. Mm-hmm. And that would be the gig economy service that I use rather frequently. I do try to support a local business at least once a week by ordering some sort of takeout item via DoorDash. And I can remember one time I logged in and it said, we're not doing deliveries right now. And I thought, interesting. Mm-hmm. One would think that this would be the time to do so, but yeah.
Absolutely. Interesting stuff, and obviously morphing and changing, and no doubt we're going to talk about it again. We have yet another awesome person joining us. With so many people working from home right now, companies are put in an awkward position when it comes to ensuring that their employees are actually being, you know, productive, working effectively, right? Everybody's working at home. A lot of employers have been very resistant to have work from home as part of their kind of company culture. And I think a large part of that is that employers, you know, wonder, like, well, how effective can you actually be at home? Well, now we're kind of put in this position where people have to be working from home largely. The way they would, you know, these companies want to be able to keep track or tabs on their employees in a similar way that they would if they were in the office. At least that's how the thinking goes. So they're turning to digital solutions that give them eyes into how their employees are doing their work. And joining us to talk about the usage of surveillance software to track these employees and their effectiveness is Drew Harwell from The Washington Post. Welcome to the show, Drew.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to get you on today. We really appreciate you taking the time. So let's start first with some of these technologies. I had not heard of some of these names until I read through your article, but it really sounds like they're kind of seeing a little bit of a boom right now. It makes a whole lot of sense. Our previous, you know, segment was talking about, you know, the companies that are thriving versus those that are kind of suffering in this time. This seems like a time of opportunity for companies who are employing kind of like surveillance technologies for employers to put on their employees' phones or devices. Talk a little bit about some of the companies that you reported on.
Yeah, so a number of these companies have been sort of in the existing space already. They've been on employees' computers when they're in the office, but now they're kind of distributing that surveillance into people's homes because so many of us are trapped in our home offices. And yeah, these are companies like HubStaff, InnerGuard, who do actual sort of screen sharing, worker sort of employee monitoring. They will log, you know, the tabs on an employer's computer, when they're online, when they're active, based off of their mouse and keyboard use. So there's a whole sort of layer of surveillance there. There's also sort of another side that's a little more friendly, but it still revolves around active, webcam and microphone use. Employees sort of asked to keep their webcams and microphones ready at all times so they can just hop on a quick video call whenever they want. So you're seeing, you know, this layer of monitoring of employees that's really intricate and really kind of all encompassing, and I think workers mostly expected this when they were in the office. You're using a company computer, you know that the company's going to be watching what you do when you're in the office. But, you know, now that it's moving sort of deeper into people's lives, it's a little more sticky.
Yeah, no kidding. Now, so the employees, obviously, you know, I think as an employee, and especially when I worked for like a corporation, I kind of always assumed like if this is a company issued device, like I kind of just kind of assumed that my employer had eyes into the device. Like that's just the price that you pay for, you know, using, let's say, the laptop that your company gives you. Are employees aware of kind of the deeper capabilities of these systems, or is that kept kind of covert from them? Like, oh, we know there's a system on there. We just don't know exactly what it's capable of.
Yeah, not really. Sometimes employees have no idea. And some of these apps are a little more covert than others. They can be installed in the background so that employees don't really know that they are being used. There's one, InnerGuard, that, you know, it doesn't show up in your system tray. You have no idea that the program is running. It pops up whenever you start your computer. And, you know, the client in that relationship really is your boss. It's telling the manager, hey, we can make sure that your workers are being productive. We can flag whenever, you know, if they're on Monster looking for another job, you'll get an automated alert. So there's definitely kind of a layer of almost espionage for some of these programs. But there's a whole another side of it too that's sort of based around social connectivity, where it does sort of require the worker to actively open the app. You know, there are services that are, you know, friendly, let's replicate the office thing. We're all in like one big sort of virtual chat room together. We all kind of watch each other. We can pop into each other's rooms and stuff and have this really easy conversation. So there's, you know, surprisingly, there's a wide range of these services. And, you know, they are finding a huge niche here because there are a ton of managers who I think rightly or wrongly maybe don't trust their workers to be getting their jobs done, or they feel like they need some, you know, more sophisticated metric to ensure that their workers aren't slacking off at home. But it all comes down to trust, really. I mean, you know, do the managers really trust their workers to be getting the job done from 9 to 5 or whenever their hours are? Or, you know, are they going to fall back on this extra layer of scrutiny to make sure that they're happy with how their workers are working?
Yeah, yeah. One thing that came to mind when I was reading through this, so one of the softwares that you write about is from a company called Pragly, and you know it talks about how they've got the water cooler room that you can go into to you know with your fellow employees to have like water cooler talk, and then you've got the silent room where you work with just your microphone open, no talking, to kind of simulate the sound, I guess, of like an office environment while you're focusing. Thought that one was kind of weird, but in all of these cases here, anyways, it's about taking what we know of office environments, what we're used to, this like in-person environment, the elements and the things that make it that and what we're used to, and then applying it to this new kind of world order of work, at least in the near term. And I guess the question that kind of came to me through that is, well, okay, I understand why someone might attempt to do that, but is that the best way? Because the dynamics are so different. Like maybe we just work differently at home, and that's neither bad nor good. It's just different. Any of the people that you spoke with, was there kind of an understanding along those lines of like, well, I understand why they're doing it, but maybe it could be done differently. Maybe it doesn't have to follow this like usual mold of what working means.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, that is the central tension here. The sales pitch from a company like Pragly is, hey, a lot of people don't want to be working from home. They feel totally isolated. You know, they like the sense of being able to just pop over and have a quick chat with their coworkers. And, you know, maybe we can replicate that environment, use the internet to decrease the distance between people. And there are boosters for that. Some people feel like, oh, this is great. We can communicate. I personally, as an introvert, think that sounds horrible, right? You know, I can get my work done at home. You know, I like talking to my coworkers, but in these little stretches, and then I can have creative time on the other side. So there are some people who feel like this is just too much, that it's social overload. And, you know, I think there's sort of good intentions from a lot of these managers to some of these systems where they feel like, let's instill this sense of corporate camaraderie. Let's have this office environment that people can replicate in this really, you know, weird time. But, you know, other people were telling me and have certainly been saying since the story came out, it's just too much. It's really exhausting me. I've got so much other stuff going on in my life. I've got a full workload, and now there's this whole other layer of kind of awkward, quasi-optional, scrutiny and camaraderie that I'm expected to fall in line with.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned in your article, NordVPN was quoted as saying that the workday by its accounting has expanded from 8 hours a day to roughly 11 hours a day, 3 hours a day difference there. And I can do math. And I guess what I'm trying to figure out through this, like that's a pretty large jump by anyone's, you know, accounting. How do we draw lines? Like I know between personal life and work life, because I know I fall into this category too. And I work for a company who is very like, I feel like Twit is very liberal as far as like how we choose to construct our day and work here. They aren't, you know, dropping the hammer to say, no, you got to be right in front of your webcam from this to this time. So we're given flexibility to kind of figure out how it works because they know we have families and we've got to homeschool and do all this stuff around it. So I feel very grateful for that. But even with all that freedom, I still feel like I'm never 100% disconnected from work to be in my personal zone. And I'm never 100% disconnected from my personal zone to be in my work mindset. How do employees draw that line, especially when there's this layer of surveillance that's tacked on?
It's really hard. Everybody is struggling with that. I mean, you know, people feel very blessed to work from home, and certainly there's, you know, a layer of comfort in having that. But it's just like you said, it's so hard for people to turn off, you know, and there's also this feeling of, I don't have any excuse. How do I say no? My boss knows I'm going to be at home, you know, and so some of the people were even writing into these like ask a manager, like help services saying like, what do I do? I'm getting all these Zoom happy hour invites. I'm getting emails around the clock. I feel, pressure to respond at any time. And so I am working a lot. And, you know, on top of this is the real kind of irony is that a lot of managers feel like workers are home slacking off. And so right at the same time that they're feeling like that, their workers are feeling, oh my God, I'm working harder than ever. And, you know, I think it's a huge learning curve for a lot of us who are working remotely for the first time ever. How do I draw those boundaries when I don't have any easy excuse? And when the rest of my life, the rest of my personal life and all my anxieties around the virus, those are just as chaotic. And so, you know, I think that's something that every employee is struggling with, you know, on a day-to-day level. I think some managers are probably handling it better than others. And, you know, some managers are dealing with these own stresses from themselves. You know, how do I maintain a normal, healthy work-life balance while still being productive and still being there for the people I work with? So it's a challenge. And then you add on this extra layer of, I have to appease the machine, right? I have to be on the video chat. I have to be showing, you know, if the system is tracking my activity level, I have to show that I'm on, you know, Excel or Outlook at however many hours of the day. So yeah, it's a real challenge for people, and it's really not going away.
The other thing that I thought was interesting when you were talking about how people feel like they can't have the freedom to kind of, I don't know, dissent against the requirements, these like overburdening requirements from their employer. Right now, considering what all companies are going through, you know, we talked earlier in the show about a number of, you know, once powerful gig economy businesses that are now laying off tons and tons of people. So there's that constant like underlying threat that employees feel that's like, okay, well, I'm fortunate to have a job right now, so I've got to do everything in my power to keep it. And in the end, they just end up sacrificing so much more of themselves just to stay attached to that job.
Yeah, you're absolutely seeing that. Workers just don't feel like they have the standing to push back or criticize because they're feeling, you know, lucky to have the job in the first place. And in that, you know, in that economy, in this ecosystem that workers are having to deal with, they're also getting this extra layer of scrutiny that they may not want, that they would love to push back on in a normal time. So, you know, all of this grind is adding on to workers, and it's making, you know, the work life really hard for people. And, you know, these are really strange times for everybody. They're having to work at home. They're not really getting the normal rewards that they were getting out when they were going in for the workday. They're not having these serendipitous meetings where you drop in and say hi to somebody. You know, some people thrive off of those things. The water cooler chat in real life is, you know, that kind of social situation is really important for people. So to take all of that stuff away as this virus has done, and then to add on this, you know, what one source told me is the crumbs of human connection, these sort of Zoom happy hours and these calls, you know, some people love them, but some people just feel totally exhausted by them. All of this mixing in together, plus on top of a normal, you know, crazy workload for people and everything else, it's just becoming a lot, and it's making people sort of question, how long can this go on? Like, I need to find a healthy medium to stay productive here, or I'm just going to totally burn out.
Yeah, absolutely. Drew Harwell, WashingtonPost.com. Drew, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today about this. If people want to follow you online, where can they do so?
Twitter, Drew Harwell, read the Washington Post, subscribe if you want. I'll see you online.
Right on. Thank you, Drew. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.
All right. Well, Micah, that it means we're at the end of Tech News Weekly. This show publishes every Thursday. We do it each and every Thursday here at twit.tv/TNW. That's where you can go. That's the show page where you can find all the ways to subscribe, audio and video formats. Do that, because when you subscribe, the show downloads automatically for you, and it makes us happy. It makes our sponsors happy, to be honest. And it makes you happy because you don't have to work so hard to get the episode. So twit.tv/TNW, go there and subscribe and jump to YouTube if that's your thing.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Also, yeah, if you'd like to follow us online, you can do so by going to Twitter, where we are at Twit on Twitter. We are at twit.tv on Instagram, at Twit Talk on TikTok. And if you want to tweet at me, I'm at Micah Sargent, and I'm also at Micah Sargent on pretty much all of the social media networks. Later on today, my next episode of Hands on iOS is coming out, and it's all about privacy. It's all about taking control of your privacy on your device using the tools that are already right there on your iOS device. So no extra apps or anything like that. You just hop in and take care of your privacy. It's a pretty important episode, so be sure to check it out. What about you, Jason?
Nice. Well, you can find me at Jason Howell on Twitter. My new show, Hands on Android, well, new-ish, I guess today's release is episode 12. It's about 3 months old now. We can celebrate that. Today's episode just went up. Thank you, John, for editing and publishing that. I really appreciate it. This week's episode is actually a focus on OnePlus 8, but more specifically Oxygen OS, which is the Android kind of OS layer on top of Android. And it's one of my favorite Android skins. And so I talk about some tips and tricks, things that I really like about Oxygen OS running on the OnePlus 8. So if you go to twit.tv/HOA12, you can find that episode or just twit.tv/HOA for hands on Android and subscribe to that as well. And you'll get all that Android goodness in your face. That's right. Mm. Thanks to Burke at the studio, as well as John at the studio for keeping things running, pushing buttons, making all this technology stuff happen for you guys. And thanks to you for watching and listening each and every week. We do appreciate it. We'll see you next week on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Goodbye, good friends. Goodbye.
Goodbye to you.